then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 11th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, I'll start off this week with a few miscellaneous bits and pieces. First off, on the whacking of the two Texas prosecutors and the Colorado prison commandant, I just spent about half an hour Googling, and I noticed some interesting things. The two cases are starting to drop off the radar, as one might expect, since the news cycle in this country is so short, the American attention span is so short as well. I mean, something has to be on the level of a tsunami to stay in the news longer than 3 or 4 days, unless it's something like Sandy Hook that the dictatorship wants to keep on playing up for political mileage. But the fact that these cases are being allowed to slide off the radar is significant in and of itself. There hasn't been anywhere near the propaganda offensive I had expected last week to gin up hatred against so-called white supremacists and create this huge media monster of an armed white rebellion. And if anything, you would think that would be a big boost to the dictatorship's gun control efforts if they were able to claim that they have to take away everybody's guns because wicked white racists might be using semi-autos to plug all those warm and fuzzy and cuddly lawyers. In fact, there have been several media articles and videos from the so-called prison gang experts, and again, I have no idea where the media find these people or exactly what qualifies them as experts, but anyway, these talking heads are saying that frankly, this does not look like the work of the Aryan Brotherhood because that's just not the way prison gangs roll, which I could have told them myself. I have always been, frankly, amazed that any capable white men who end up in the slave labor camps, which is what the prison system is these days, in fact, do not retaliate against the evil, rich bastards and bitches in $2,000 power suits who put them there. God knows they have reason enough. After doing one of these insane, crushing sentences and being forced to work for the state or be farmed out to some private corporation the governor's got a kickback deal with for 50 cents a day for years, you would think that any white man who got out would make a beeline for the blood of the filthy swine who did that to him. But, for whatever reason, we don't. One of our comrades put it to me this way a while back. White people are rule followers, and so we are. God help us. And if we don't quit following the rules, we're going to be gone from the earth in a century. Whatever it is, including terrible harm to ourselves and to our own children, we just lie down and take it, like we lie down and take everything else. American white people just plain will not resist. I guess it's because there's no money or drugs or sexual weirdness involved, which is what seems to motivate white people on the fewer and fewer occasions when we do get proactive. That's us. We'll get proactive for money. Oh yeah, riffle those $100 bills under our ear and we'll slaughter our own grandmothers. Sometimes literally. Hop us up on drugs and we'll do things. Throw in some sex, especially sex that's abnormal or kinky in some way, and we'll do all kinds of nasty violent things. But white men don't take revenge anymore. Probably one of the reasons why no one respects us anymore. American white people will not lift a finger for anything political or racial or for any cause beyond themselves, their own greed or lust or hurt feelings, even when it's clearly a matter of life and death that we do so. It's what we've become. This is what the Jews have made us, and this is why, after some thought, I am increasingly skeptical about this latest rash of official killings being in any way the work of so-called white supremacists. It's just not our style. White men don't do that anymore. A few things are starting to come out. It looks now like District Attorney Mike McClelland or his wife may have let the killer in because there is no sign of forced entry. And this was about dawn at 6 o'clock in the morning or so. The authorities are still being cagey about what kind of weapon was used, but before they clammed up, the early news reports were gabbling about how it was allegedly a quote-unquote assault rifle. Now, are you going to let somebody into your home at dawn carrying an AR-180 or a Mini 14 or whatever whom you don't know? Apparently, Mike McClellan was expecting trouble. He had loaded his home with well over a dozen handguns, and according to his own son, he literally had a pistol within reach anywhere he went or sat down in the house. So this didn't come out of the blue. McClelland knew somebody was after him. I think he knew more than he was telling about why his assistant, Haas, got gunned down in the street 2 months before. And boy, were they ever after his ass, since whoever it was evidently fired over 20 bullets into his body. Now that's either very personal, or else it's several bursts on full automatic. Now, I repeat, when you've got somebody who's as paranoid and twitchy as Mike McClelland apparently was, how the hell do you get such a person to open the door to you in the dawn on March 31st while you're carrying a machine gun? I have to admit, this is starting to appeal to the mystery writer in me. Now, there's one more thing, and I can't get any kind of even halfway reputable citation for this. It's just internet buzz, so it's probably useless. But it does raise some interesting possibilities. There is a buzz going around the net that the reason these two prosecutors got whacked is not because they were after the Aryan Brotherhood, but because they were investigating a high-level ring of homosexual pedophiles and the people who were procuring little boys for them, usually by abduction. Now, that would make sense. Pre-adolescent buggery is virtually the only pleasure which law and custom still denies, even to the extremely wealthy and powerful, in theory anyway. So, needless to say, it's the one pleasure they go to great lengths to satisfy illegally. Look at Michael Jackson. For decades, there have been rumors of rings or secret cults of wealthy and powerful men at the very top of Western liberal democracy and international finance, who avail themselves of small children, usually little white boys, at places like Bohemian Grove, etc., etc. Now, some of you may remember a book from the 1980s called The Franklin Cover-Up by John DeCamp, which discussed the existence of such pedophile rings here in the United States. I myself have to admit that I was skeptical at first when all this stuff started coming out. I mean, it sounded a little paranoid even by our own standards. And then, in the mid-1990s, the Marc Dutroux case in Belgium somehow slipped through the media blackout. Now, Dutroux was a former Belgian police sergeant who was arrested for kidnapping young girls and forcing them to do kiddie porn and then selling the girls themselves on to unnamed buyers for recreational purposes, after which the children disappeared. He also murdered a couple of these little girls who were unsatisfactory in various ways to the wealthy perverts who bought them. Now, Dutroux got caught, and somehow liberal democracy's usual containment protocols for this kind of thing failed, I think because the Dutroux case had one of the few honest prosecutors remaining in Europe. The media got hold of what was known as the X-Files, meaning statements from witnesses who were supposed to be secret and who were all designated as X1, X5, X16, so forth and so on. Now, these files revealed the identities of some of this kiddie pimp's paying customers, i.e. members of the Belgian political and financial elite, and some of the most rich and powerful men in liberal socialist Europe. So, as was legally established 17 years ago, these things do happen. Now, I've been wondering, if this thing in Texas is supposed to be some kind of uprising on the part of a white prison gang, why this one county and this one district attorney's office only? Yes, they recently worked on some kind of AB conspiracy case and indicted a bunch of these guys, most of whom were still in prison and who are going to remain there all their lives. So why exactly would the ABs be sufficiently angry about them to do something that they've never done before, i.e. start killing district attorneys? Now, on the other hand, if Haas and McClellan were getting close to a high-level ring of boy-buggering bugger boys in the Texas political and business elite, that would be a horse of another color. Let's assume that being good shouting Baptist conservatives, they wouldn't back off. Now, the establishment in Texas is based on fossil fuel, big energy, big bucks. They've got more than enough money to hire professionals to take care of a problem like that. Now, granted, I would be a little more confident if I could find some kind of source on this besides our own internet. Our sites and podcasts can be surprisingly good sometimes, but how can I put this? Sometimes they have a tendency to be a little bit overenthusiastic and to tell it like it should be rather than like it is. Call it wishful thinking. Well, we'll see how it plays out. Now, if this story simply disappears, that in itself may be our answer. Okay, got an anonymous email which might be a heckling idiot or it might be a serious question. I can't tell you, but I'll treat it as serious. Question for HAC, if a financial meltdown is the event where the balloon is going to go up, why didn't the Great Depression starting in 1929 do that? The severe recession of the early 1980s, etc. Well, first off, those economic disasters actually did inflict very serious consequences on the country, which we never recovered from. Not the least being the New Deal, which began America's long, slow slide into Marxism light back in 1933. But if I start rambling off onto a long historical digression, I'll have to make this podcast a 2-CD performance, and so I'll just hit a few high points. Now, the short and snappy answer to your question is that in 1929 and even in the 1980s, America was in a lot better shape racially, economically, and morally than we are today. A stronger patient can survive an attack of plague bacillus once, twice, maybe more, but eventually he becomes so weak through all the excessive bouts of his disease that he finally just isn't strong enough to fight it off anymore and he dies. Especially since the disease itself keeps getting stronger with each successive onset. America has survived repeated attacks of the liberal democratic pestilence over the past century. Sort of. But each attack, each pointless war, each pointless depression or recession, each period of acute moral crisis like the 60s or Watergate or 8 years of neocon rule or the present gay marriage crap has left the patient weaker and weaker. I genuinely do believe that the next major attack, which may well turn out to be Obamacare combined with some kind of war with Iran or maybe North Korea, will kill the patient this time. Okay, even at this short distance into the podcast, I can tell this one's going to run long, and so I need to stop with that last observation and let you hear another voice for a bit.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here, and you're all in for a treat. Today I'm actually going to be positive. Well, in my opinion, I've always been positive, since I'm making an effort at convincing you to do the right thing for yourself, your family, and your race, but that seems to have slipped under the radar. I'm going to be much more explicitly positive since the content of Radio Free Northwest, along with the remarks from others associated with the party, has rubbed a few people raw as of late. Before I really get going, I can't help but point out the obvious problem of claiming the party isn't positive. This has been dealt with before on Radio Free Northwest, though not for some time. Since it's been a while, I'll briefly remind the audience of a few key points. First, assuming some of you actually commit to migrating right as this comes out, we won't see you anywhere near the homeland for at least a year, and that's a downer. No, really, I mean that. We would genuinely rather you be here. Believe it or not, that's actually out of a desire for your welfare in addition to our races. Second, we really don't have that much to be positive about. Despite what some of you think about how well the movement has done in the past, repeating those tactics to whip up a frenzy of, something, is just going to get everyone itching to do something, and that never ends well. The only thing to do is come home and help us form a revolutionary party capable of securing the existence of our people and a future for white children in the Pacific Northwest. And third, your reaction to the call for your homecoming is where the negativity comes from, not the party. I've told my story in a few different ways, with a different emphasis each time on what I thought was pertinent. but today I'm going to focus on my immediate reaction after being presented with the party website for the first time. You might recall I had recently made the choice to become permanently racial, though without touching the white nationalist movement for obvious reasons. I was genuinely desirous of a solution to our race's impending demise, and someone actually bothered to do what you're all supposed to be doing, and they managed to get the NorthwestFront.org website address in front of my face on a racial website. I had already gotten over America, and since I had recently admitted my racist beliefs to myself, I was literally begging for something else. Anything else. And there it was. Sure, I was a bit skeptical at first, but I did my homework and read the whole website while listening to a few episodes of Radio Free Northwest. After about the third episode, the actual proposal of seizing territory for the purpose of creating an all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest sunk in. This Covington guy was serious. I did a lot more listening and got a hold of PDF copies of the novels. I didn't want to wait to get into one of them. After realizing the method of procuring said real estate for said new nation, I genuinely became nervous for about a week. I wasn't nervous about the idea that I would be carted off for reading a bad book, but I really was nervous about the idea such a thing might truly be possible. And then, I realized I wasn't nervous at all. Instead, I had become grateful. And I wasn't grateful to anyone or anything in particular. I was just plain grateful. I got what I wanted. The way to end the indignities suffered by our race on a minute-by-minute basis in a world run by the Jew. Without belaboring the point too much longer, I wasn't convinced entirely until after reading the party's introduction packet and exploring everything I could about the feasibility of a campaign like the one recommended in the Northwest novels. But sure enough, it's all on the up and up. It really can be done. I'll never understand what causes any other reaction from any other white man or woman when they get to this point. In theory, you claim to want everything we're offering, and when we get to the point where you have to make a decision one way or the other, all we get out of most people is that we're being negative and too hard on them. Let's explore that reaction. I'm generating this material not too long after Mr. Covington posted on his Thought Crime blog a letter from a comrade overseas, lamenting the state of Americans who can't be bothered to pack a moving van and drive down the highway. I've spoken with many people from other countries who desperately want to come home, and I've had the distinct pleasure of meeting a few of them on scouting trips of various sorts. These people are all more grateful than I at the mere prospect of coming home. Right around the period of November 2010, when I had been on the party mailing list for a couple of months, Mr. Covington was still unsure about writing novel number 5 and sent out an email on that topic saying he was afraid people would use it as an excuse to do more nothing. Someone flipped out about this and told him he was too negative and that he did not inspire in an email response. Mr. Covington chose to handle this in front of the whole list. As it turns out, this whiner had decided to stay in his Chicago suburb of all places and had no intention of ever coming home. How exactly are we to be positive enough to inspire such a man? Really, what is positivity? I can tell you what it's not. It's not the party pulling a rabbit out of its hat. It's not putting on a podcast every week full of the usual racial tripe from all over the internet. And it's definitely not making lazy, middle-aged Americans squeal with delight that their race faces imminent genocide if something doesn't change. Right when this email exchange was taking place over the party's contact list, I had my first of several job leads and I was engaging in the process which would eventually bring me to Seattle. I could barely believe what I heard, so I shot off an email to Mr. Covington detailing my disgust and disbelief at the situation. Even then, I had a hard time processing why everyone on the party list wasn't grateful enough to make the same homecoming efforts I ran myself ragged with. Does the Covington Donner thesis spring to mind? Well, it should. This was the first anecdotal evidence of it I would come across. Everyone who does this essentially tells the party, I'm not going to ever do any of this since I don't believe in it, but what you need to do is... And it cracks me up every time I hear it. It's just as anti-organization as anything else. I mean, really. I'm going to tell the Northwest Front what it needs to do so I can get a movement high like I actually did something, even though I secretly think my advice is bogus since I'm not willing to follow it myself. In a weird way, I can see what this guy meant, but let's dissect his commentary to fully understand where we ought to go with this. He's unwilling to be inspired himself, but he fully expects other people to be, or else he wouldn't get on Mr. Covington's case about it. If he expects other people to respond, then he must be fully aware of our race's impending extinction. So what's his hang-up? Why isn't he here now? After all, he was on the party contact list before I was, and I took a year to migrate 1.5 years ago. Therefore, it's a safe bet he's at least 3 years old, so it's time he grew up. Why do so many people, upon being made fully aware of what opportunity the party offers them, sulk back down into their couches and mope like they didn't even know the Butler Plan exists? If it's not obvious by now where I'm going with this, I'll make it plain. They're clearly not grateful for the chance to help secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. If they are, they sure show it in a funny way. I've made it a point to deal with the goofy behavior of movement personalities who are trying to do anything but come home. They work so hard to get everyone around them pumped up for their race, and when someone like me comes along with a real-world activity, which could use some of that energy and excitement, these same people, who were only seconds before so fired up, mumble some absurd excuse and saunter off in search of the same high. The same high they had to come down from just long enough to tell the party how wrong we are. At any rate, they could choose to be grateful for what they claim to have wanted when they received it. Is that really even so hard? To admit to yourself you're glad you have a chance to turn the tide of history? The only other option is to wallow in the abject failure of the movement status quo and then be doomed to perpetuating it. Migration is positive. It's good for you and for our race. Homecoming is positive. It's to your benefit. Refusing to heed any longer the siren song of America and all it falsely offers you for compliance with your own genocide doesn't have anything negative about it. The only possible way a person can claim we're a negative influence on them is if our call to action somehow forces them to face down their own character faults. Of course, your character faults aren't something we're responsible for. At worst, you could say we're offering you the means to develop your personal discipline to the point required to help form a fighting revolutionary party to save your race from extinction. But I'm still missing the negative in there. In all honesty, there's plenty to be positive about, and with each new migrant or migrant family, there's more all the time. Your own insecurities about this fact might not be so positive, though, and this only means you're the one that needs to change. I and the rest of the party have done our best to help you understand what real positivity looks like, and it's not the warm, tingly feeling America taught you to crave early in your life. Instead of throwing a temper tantrum at the party when we point things out you don't like about yourself, why not respond to the Northwest Imperative with the positivity you claim to seek? Hail victory, comrades.
Last week I promised you guys a White Noise episode featuring only white rock and roll, so we'll start off with, you guessed it, Ian Stewart and Screwdriver. You may recall that I nicked a few lines from this song to kick off Freedom's Sons with.
Good evening, comrades. This week I'm going to discuss a book about the Tamarin mummies. These mummies have been something that scholars have been aware of in the Western world, at least for the last, 30 years or so. But around the year 2000, Victor Marr was traveling in China doing archaeology research and kind of rediscovered these mummies and rediscovered apparently a batch of them that were in a storeroom. The towns in this area are mentioned in the historical record as being Caucasian areas. For example, they're talked about during the Han Dynasty. The Kushans are known for having introduced Buddhism, apparently in this region, I guess around, I don't know what we'd call it if we'd call it the, prior to the Middle Ages, there was a huge conversion to Buddhism. And there was farming in some of these towns. You had things like red millet, wheat, grapes, pomegranates. So you had these sort of foods from the Middle Eastern and Western area being introduced into China. There was one town that was very close to the mountains, and apparently there was a lot of mining, and they were able to get things like copper, gold, and tin, and ammoniac, which was used for tanning, which was very important because they used leather a lot, and you find evidence of this with the mummies. Now, eventually in the Middle Ages, these towns were overrun by the Muslims, and that's where we see the Uyghurs coming into play, and those are the people that live there now that are Muslims, and they're kind of a Turkish-Mongoloid mix. This one area called Hrohran gives us the best examples of the mummies, and that's where we have this Hrohran beauty, which is one of the very famous mummies. These mummies were very much naturally produced because the soil there is very salty, and that's one of the most important things in making mummies, is just simply the drying out, the desiccation. The Chinese are always sort of encroaching into these areas, and around 119 AD, Ban Yang recommended that the government make a colony there. So they're always trying to encroach, and that's something the Uyghurs even complain about to this day. The Wusan group, which was another one of these white towns, gave the Han some horses, which were very esteemed, and they were called the Heavenly Horses. There were some interesting religions in these areas, and one of them that occurred was this sort of fusion religion called Manichaeism, and it was this sort of idea that you would either go to paradise after you died or you'd be reborn, but it was crushed in the 5th and 6th centuries by Christianity. And then we also find this other form of Christianity called Nestorian Christianity, which is kind of like the Unitarians. They downplayed the divinity of Jesus and denied the divinity of Mary. The strange thing about Tocharan, which they think is the language these mummies probably spoke, or at least spoke primarily, is that it seems to be a Western Indo-European language that is even to the east of the Eastern Indo-European languages, so it's in a very strange location. Of course, one of the most exciting things in Indo-European studies is always trying to locate this homeland, this Indo-European homeland. We know that it's temperate in climate, but that kind of covers a lot of territories in both Asia and also in Europe. So that's not terribly helpful, but we know some of the species of various animals that were there. But again, it's not terribly helpful. It's temperate, and we're dealing with widespread species, so it's been terribly difficult. I've had to finally concede that they'll probably never know. As much as I'd like to know, or I once had a great burning desire to know where this was, but the experts will probably never agree. One of the places that has sort of crossed my mind is possibly even northern India, because I was watching a documentary about the flora and fauna of northern India, and apparently there are some very mountainous regions that are very temperate. And they have bears, and they have things like pine trees, and it's really not what you think of when you think of India. It's not tropical, it doesn't seem to be hot, it seems to be everything the opposite of that. But there's different theories. I mean, there's the Anatolian theory, which sort of follows the plow, it follows the beginnings of farming. There's also Kurgan theory, which is the one I sort of grew up with and didn't really know anything different until I was a bit older, maybe even, I don't know, in my 20s somewhere before I found out about the Anatolian theory. The Kurgan theory kind of follows corded ware as opposed to the agriculture of the Anatolian theory. But apparently they had sheep and they had cereal grains and they had wheeled vehicles. And there also seems to be this obsession with Bedra, and that could have been for shamanistic purposes, that could have been for also medical purposes. Ephedra apparently raises blood pressure, and it's very helpful for asthma. And actually, out on the steppe, there were a lot of lung problems, and this book doesn't go into this so much, but apparently in the desert, it gets very cold at night, so they built a lot of fires, and there was inhaling a lot of smoke, and also the sands from the desert. So you had a lot of lung ailments, and they would actually attempt lung surgeries, where they would actually take out the lung, wash, and put it back in. And apparently some people actually lived through this, but it sounds like a really insane type of surgery. These grave sites often were marked by circular rock formations. They also often had wood that they would put almost like tree trunks and sometimes representations of human figures that would sort of stand in the middle of this desert, and it's quite a haunting appearance. They also seem to have a lot of bronze axes in these graves, and so they may have developed bronze even before the Chinese did. There are all these different graves, and they have different dates. They're thought to maybe date between 1750 through 1300 BC, but that's disputed, and then there's this other possible dates for them. One of the things we see on the bodies, we see a lot of tattoos. That's almost a ubiquitous thing. Now, there's variations in how these bodies are dressed. Some of them are merely wrapped in blankets. Others are actually fully dressed, and it really seems that the ones that are dressed for winter tend to be the best preserved. And that's possibly because the winter season, because it was cold, was really the best time for these bodies to get preserved, because you have to understand that this preservation was really very much accidental. They didn't really have to do too much to these bodies to preserve them except for the chin straps. Although they may have used some kind of home remedies, they may have used some emollients. Another thing is these bodies are buried in deep pits with a lot of sort of sticks in various layers of these pits, and they sort of don't know why. Maybe they thought it would help preserve the bodies in some way, but it may have also been a religious purpose, because sticks are used in divinations of trying to, rather like runes, I would suppose. The interesting thing is we see these textiles, and they're very colorful. They had wonderful dyes. They used a lot of felt. They also made a lot of twill weaves. At one point, in one particularly outstanding textile, we have a painting of actually this man that he's obviously Caucasian. They're not sure what nationality he is. Could be a merchant from the local area, maybe a Sorka or a Sargon or maybe even a Roman, according to different analysts, different historians. We do find children, but they're usually buried separately. And there are some outstanding examples of this. Some died as babies because of just a very high infant mortality rate in those days. They're often wrapped up in various blankets, and there's one called the Blue Boy that's very elaborately wrapped and just very attractively dressed. So it's just in itself, it's wonderful to see these textiles. There's even a kind of settlement at one place called Tanger Trough, which was either a real house or simply literally something called a kurgan a house for the dead. So they don't really know why it was made, but they find a lot of examples of the architecture at the time, of the stone walls that they built, and also of even certain very interesting cauldrons that they used. Another very interesting way to find out about these people, particularly for the Tocharans, is because of the Buddhism that came about in a later period, because the Buddhists tended to cremate their dead, so these mummies were not Buddhists, but the type persisted for a long time out on the steppe, and you can see these donor photos where they have a certain way of dress that is different from the Chinese. They have belted tunics, and again, you can see their Caucasian features. Now, one of the problems with these mummies is they're not very well cared for by the Chinese, because the Chinese like to say that they developed in isolation and they don't really like to admit to having these mummies. But the Uyghurs really like this Crowron beauty, one of these very famous mummies, and they're always using her as evidence of their continual occupation of the steppe lands. The authors of this book say that's not entirely warranted, although they are admittedly more Caucasoid than certainly the Mongoloid Chinese. Another thing that we see in these mummies is evidence of high standing in society, because a lot of them have fairly long nails, and while it doesn't really grow after death, that's a crazy rumor, that couldn't really happen, but what does happen is as the flesh dries out, the nail can appear slightly longer. However, some of these mummies have really fairly long nails, and the thing is that this shows status, because they would not have worked with their hands, and therefore it would allow the nail to grow. The other interesting thing about some of these mummies, particularly the mummy called Ur-David, is that they had certain sun symbols and kind of whirligigs that were often drawn on their faces, and others have, it could either be tattooed symbols or symbols drawn with various types of makeup, as we see with Ur-David, that were sometimes sun symbols, which could have indicated a religion. And we also see some priestesses that are kind of dressed as witches. They have the pointy hats. Another mummy that may have been a Sogdian merchant or possibly a dancer that's actually wearing a mask. So just very interesting, different periods of time, different forms of dress. They've tested these mummies, and they found that the one who they were allowed to test belonged to the mitochondrial group H, or the group that they call Helena. That's a group that if you've ever had your mitochondrial DNA tested by Oxford Ancestors, that's one of the European groups. They also find that a lot of these mummies seem to test as blood group O, and as they look at the various mummies, of course, they find more European genes towards the west and more Eastern genes towards the east, quite naturally. Now, they're not completely sure language these mummies spoke at home, and there's a lot of theorizing about this, but they think that their language was probably Tocharan. But there's a lot of question of how did they get to that area and how much influence the Androvov culture was to them, because that was another culture where they had a somewhat similar form of burial, although theirs was much more elaborate, and they always had horses in their burial chambers. There's different explanations for how the Terrans got to where they were. There's kind of the short track and the long track. Either from Europe or from a place called Afaseno, which is also in the steppe area, with the Afaseno seeming more plausible because it's a shorter way to go and just seems to make more sense. This book is really very complex in a way because there's a lot in here having to do with these steppe cultures that are really rather exotic. There's even talk of, in some of these cultures, would actually use a cradleboard method to deform the skull as a sign of status. Rather like actually some Native Americans used also. So this is really the exotic side of Western culture, these steppe cultures. And with these cultures, we also get the animal art style. So this is really as exotic as Western culture gets. And yet you'll see these familiar styles of clothing, for example. It is very much a Western culture. So again, the title of the book is The Tamarin Mummies, and it's by J.P. Mallory and Victor H. Mayer, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this talk.
While I promised you a podcast of nothing but rock music, I did not necessarily promise skinhead rock. This is a Finnish group called Korpiklaani. Okay, Gretchen went pretty long on this show, which is fair enough since I wasn't able to get her on last week. And now we've got about 20 minutes left, which isn't going to be long enough for me to cover this topic in one show, so I'll just kick it off as best I can. I promised one of our people several weeks ago that I would devote some time here to lessons in what Lenin called the conspiratorial method. Now, never mind the Lenin bit. If you still don't understand why I make those references, you never will. I, on my part, understand that despite some years of my explaining in detail, the overwhelming majority of you simply have no idea exactly what it is that I want you to actually do. Well, no, that's not right. Let's be honest. You do know what I want you to do. You just don't want to do it. Now, we have a plan here in the Northwest, something no one else has. We have a strategy that will secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, which I spend every week explaining. But then the show ends and the great disconnect sets in, which is the whole story of our movement. The huge, yawning chasm between what is said, which is everything, and what is done, which is nothing. I tell you what to do here to secure the existence of our people, and it's treated as a form of entertainment, like American Idol. While my novels are racist Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, but nothing that I say or write has any meaning for you personally as far as something that you would actually do, since if you did follow my roadmaps, it would involve risk and inconvenience, plus you might get in trouble with the bad men who hold real power, and the bad men might hurt you. American white boys are socially engineered from birth to avoid trouble and anything difficult by either running away or finding a workaround. Now, you must have heard that great American saying, don't work hard, work smart. How about, you got to go along to get along? Okay, look, I won't read you the riot act again. I think we all know who and what you are, and beyond a certain point, there's no useful purpose to be served in reminding you. But not all of you are like that. There are a few of you out there who are different and who are capable of responding in the way that you must if we're going to have any hope of continuing to exist. We're still looking for that first 1,000 men and women who are different and who will have the old alpha gene in their makeup and who can still go first. Now, these next few podcasts on conspiratorial method are for that small handful of alphas scattered around among our 5,000 or so weekly listeners. Once you come here, most of the herd will follow you. Now, just for the record, the first thing you need to do before you adopt the conspiratorial method or any other method is that you need to load that moving van and come home to the Pacific Northwest, where you're supposed to be. Obviously, you can't do anything, conspiratorial or otherwise, if you're not here. Okay, that having been said, now let's pick it up from the point where you've finally done what you're supposed to do. You're here now in the Pacific Northwest, where you're supposed to be. You're settled in and ready to start working for the 14 words here in the land that destiny has appointed for the purpose. What do you do? Now, what have I told you about 100 times now? Let's repeat it, and let's make sure everybody gets their arms around it. This is important. The Northwest Front is a legal movement that must operate as if it were an illegal one. And that means that we do not break the law, but law enforcement nevertheless treats us like criminals through various discriminatory acts of surveillance, harassment, illegal wiretapping, persecution, and in some cases false arrest and imprisonment, and even murder, as in the case of Edgar Steele and Jeff Hughes. We are exercising rights which technically we possess under the United States Constitution, but which the United States government does not want us to exercise, and which the said dictatorship will use persecution, deceit, and assault to prevent us from exercising. None of this is simply Harold babbling into a microphone, people. This is the way things really are, and these are the conditions that we have to work under. Now, if you're one of these white boys who thinks that you need to thrill-seek in order to be a man and have a real life, I assure you that revolutionary politics is just as extreme a sport as skydiving or snowboarding or doing jackass videos, and a lot more dangerous. So you'd think you guys would get an adrenaline rush off being with a party. Now, this means that in order to think and to speak and to live as we believe to be right, while at the same time avoiding unlawful persecution by the dictator's servants, we ourselves must adopt a modus operandi of deception and covert procedure. This is what Lenin called the conspiratorial method. And in view of the fact that Lenin won his revolution, we need to listen to him, communist or not. As in any endeavor, we need to learn mostly from past winners, not the also-rans. We have every legal and constitutional right to be who and what we are. What we lack is any way to compel the dictatorship and its agencies, like the FBI and the federal judiciary, to accept that right and to allow us to exercise it. Actually, yes, we do have such a means to compel the regime to obey their own laws in the Second Amendment to the Bill of Rights. But we lack the courage and the discipline and the powers of concentration and attention span necessary to use it properly, so effectively we have no way to compel the government to obey their own laws, which once again leads us to the conspiratorial method. Okay, right now I want to apologize for something that I'm sure you'll notice more than usual in this little series of talks of mine over the next few weeks, and that is the fact that I'm compelled to be a little more obscure even than I normally am in what I say here because of the unfriendly neighbors who are listening in over the back fence. With 5,000 hits a week, this podcast is one of the largest audiences in the white nationalist movement, and I have to use it to tell you people what you need to hear. Unfortunately, there are others listening who don't need to hear it. So I have to speak in parables and vague offhand references in the hope that those of you who have the alpha gene and who have some innate racial instinct left can use it to read between the lines. Okay, let's take a shot at it. Now, I may have mentioned this before, but I'll say it again. Do you want to learn the best mindset and read the best feel manual for living as a soldier of Northwest independence in the present time? Don't read my Northwest novels. They are of a time yet to come. Read John le Carré spy novels. Forget all that James Bond and Mission Impossible crap. That was never accurate. The le Carré novels are a lot more low-key. They teach you about the big picture of living your whole life in the shadows and, more importantly, functioning and getting the job done in the shadows. It's not glamorous. There are no Aston Martins or busty Bond babes or shaken, not stirred martinis. Life as a spy behind enemy lines is one long string of mundane, petty activities like working in some metal hangar, banging on things all day, and then washing your socks and your t-shirts in a laundromat at 7 o'clock at night, all of which add up to your cover, the camouflage that keeps the eyes of the FBI and the other secret police agencies away from you, and yet all the while still working to fulfill your mission, which is to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children through the creation of a sovereign and independent white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest. And the most effective lifestyle that a Northwest revolutionary can adopt in this time period is to consider yourself an intelligence agent, an operative behind enemy lines, which in essence is what we all are. Call us long-term sleeper agents. We're largely cut off from headquarters. We have been for 68 years. We have only the thinnest of support systems on the ground to help us in our mission. Nor do we have the numbers or the infrastructure to become proactive as yet. So the most we can do is to observe, report, and occasionally carry out small individual actions to confuse and demoralize the tyrant. And above all, we can recruit others into a growing secret army of such Northwest independence operatives. Over the next few weeks, I will be telling you about the conspiratorial method as it applies to us here in the Northwest. But it isn't so much a method as it is a way of life, and we're going to have to spend quite a while living in a John le Carré novel until one day we can use current events like a judo fighter using his opponent's own weight against him to bring about a change in our situation. And then we can live in a Harold Covington novel. In the meantime, we've got one more music break coming, and for that final number of the show, I've chosen one of the most tender and romantic love songs in the entire body of skinhead rock and roll music. Almost an emo-type song, which shows that even us racist white boys are capable of having a truly sensitive and poetic soul.
kill you and profane you. Kill you and profane you. In times of old, you came, you brought your filth, your stupid names, for our kings with your gold. Now you got us in a stranglehold. Kill you, you filthy Jew. Kill you filthy Jew. So you're free to spread your lies about the so-called Jews who died. You filthy hook no scum. Let's make it 6 million out. I'll kill you, you filthy Jew. Kill you filthy Jew. Now in the ovens I watch you breathe. I'm enjoying the freedom I found. Step your ashes into the ground. Kill you, you filthy Jew. Kill you filthy Jew. Can you hear the death rattle? Stuffed in trains just like cattle. It sounds so good to me. And why wish the fighting like free? Kill you, you filthy Jew. Kill you filthy Jew. Kill you filthy Jew. Kill you fucking dirty hell Jew.
Okay, the first thing we have to do if we're going to pull this off is what I've been telling you guys for years that we have to do. We have to change who we are. We have to cease being 21st century Americans and become at least some approximation of an older version of ourselves, early 20th century Europeans. We need to go back about 100 years and one continent. Now, what I mean here specifically is that we have to learn to look at politics from a much older and much more pure and realistic point of view. And one of the most damaging aspects of life in America over the past century is that white people have forgotten the true meaning of politics and the true nature of the political process. Our ancestors knew these things. Some Europeans, like the Golden Dawn in Greece and the Provisional IRA, still know these things. And all third worlders, Asians and Latin Americans, and even most blacks, know these things that we've forgotten and which we have to relearn. In the America we all grew up in, and in other Western countries, especially English-speaking countries, politics is considered to be a kind of grand game, a dog-and-pony show with primary elections and all kinds of television ads and debates and campaign buttons and bumper stickers and toys and conventions and speeches and finally election night on TV, with all the returns coming in and a bunch of talking head morons telling us all about what's happening. And then one side, quote-unquote, wins, and one allegedly loses. The problem is, that's not politics, that's democracy, which is not the same thing, not by a long shot. Democracy is a hoax. Now, there's a very famous quote which I just Googled and which is attributed to, among other people, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Alexis de Tocqueville. But as near as I can determine, it was actually first said by a Scots philosopher named Alexander Robeson around 1780 or so. And I quote, "Democracy as a form of government cannot last. It invariably fails when men discover that they can vote themselves money from the public funds." Whoever said it, they were describing the United States of America. Now, these elections are only about one thing. Which faction of rich, elitist bastards gets to control all that lovely tax money? I'm going to say again something that I've said before, but which all of us need to get our arms around as the beginning of that transmutation of our character that we have to perform. The purpose of democracy is to prevent change, by which I mean that the purpose of democracy is to make sure that the same people who exercise genuine power in a nation or a society continue to exercise that power. Only revolution successfully carried out effects real change as to who holds and exercises power. Politics is about power over other human beings and who gets to exercise it, specifically three kinds of power. The power to tax, i.e. the power to steal the wealth of others and to do so without retaliation. The power to compel others to do as they are commanded by force if necessary. And the power to send armed men to the doors of one's enemies to do them harm without retaliation or punishment. That's what state power is about. Who's boss? Yes, it's a form of gangsterism. Who is the sodomite and who is the catamite, if you want to put it in gay terminology? Politics is the process by which a society determines who pitches and who catches. And in modern liberal democracies, that process has not got a damn thing to do with any stupid elections, most of which are now rigged, just like Barack Hussein Obama and the Democrats rigged the 2008 and 2012 elections in this country. And just like the Democrats are now in the process of rigging all future elections through the construction of an artificial electoral majority by legalizing illegal aliens and the creation of a massive underclass dependent on taxpayer-funded benefits for their survival. It's the old battle between those who pay the taxes and those who eat the taxes, and the Democrats have won. Politics is the struggle between those who have the power and want to keep it, and those who want the power and are willing to do whatever is necessary to get it. That is the way we have to look at this struggle from now on. When I say it's them or us, I mean just that. The present regime means to make absolutely sure that power can never be returned once again to the hands of white Gentile males, and they're going to make sure of that by killing us. All of us. They may well succeed over the next 50 years if we don't quit fucking around now and start doing something to bring about real change. Now, it has been said that terrorism is the weapon of the weak against the strong, and that's true as far as it goes, but there's a problem with that. You have to be strong in order to use it. Morally strong. Spiritually strong. Not just willing to lay down your own life or risk torture and imprisonment, but willing to take upon oneself the burden of duty and the sins of history that bring about change. Now, we, American white people, as a people, are not strong. We are weak. The Jews have made us that way. The federal agents and the U.S. attorneys who are listening to this don't have to worry about anything. And they won't have to worry about anything for a long time. Dead prosecutors in Texas and prison commandants in Colorado notwithstanding, their power isn't threatened yet. Because white people are too morally frail and our hearts are too weak and frightened to fight back. Now, I can sit here babbling at you on this computer for the next 20 years until I finally keel over behind the keyboard and my body is eaten by my cat. And I can't change that fact. Only you white men listening to this can change it. By changing yourselves and by conquering your deadly fear of the tyrant and his wicked servants. I'll close with something else I've said over and over again for many years. It's not a matter of whether we can do this thing. Of course we can. We could do it tomorrow if, through some miracle, we all ceased to be so timid and weak and frightened. The question is, will we do it? Now, when you make your decision, let me know. If I'm not yet lying on the floor with the cat nibbling on my toes, I'll still be here. Our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.